This is Lena Life. I am Lena Mirmont, after some delay for which we all apologizing, especially to my extremely noble guest who was kindly enough to make his time for our interview. And his name is Professor Philip Mayer. We're going to be in a world of journalism. I cannot find more relative subject for today's society as journalism, which has a tremendous amount of purposes, modifications, and in our internet mentality, journalism certainly is changing its genre and is changing its direction. I believe that Professor Philip Mayer, one of the best, if not the best, founder of the source and roots of genuine journalism. He wrote a number of books, and he's celebrating his knowledge, talent, and dedication, writing those books, one of which called Vanishing Newspaper. I'm going to invite in a second to our discussion Professor Mayer. And before, I just like to make a little set of thoughts which are somewhat a bit unusual relating to journalistic field, because Professor Mayer attached journalism to some sides of science and business. He certainly originated of certain business model where quality and profit would find its correlation. We will be talking about the concept where an influence, according to Professor Mayer, is much more predominant and a leading point opposed to information. And, of course, it is extremely important, his position on the issue of certification, which he also will give us an understanding and his philosophical and practical platform. Professor Mayer, you're welcome. Again, thank you so much. And I just wanted to ask you to start from your general philosophy and meaning of journalism.
Oh, my God. Very broad question. I hadn't thought about it. Journalism has been around for a long time. Its philosophy is gradually evolving. It's considered essential for democracy. So I guess its purpose is to give the people the knowledge they need to be rational, democratic participants. And with the information age causing so much confusion and noise, the mission of the journalist is changing, because it used to be when information was scarce, all we had to do was find the information and take it to a willing consumer who didn't care too much about the quality because it was so hard to find in the first place. Now that information is plentiful, our job is much different. It's more a matter of organizing it and making it easy for the consumer to use. So we've gone from a hunter-gatherer mode to something that's more like, like modern agriculture, where processing is more important than production. And I think the profession is having some trouble adapting to that.
Well, I have to ask you somewhat more involved question, which has to do with a Vanishing Newspaper book. The basis, one of the basis, is your business model, which, if I understand correctly, is preserving and creates also stabilization for social responsibility of the press in a way that it can outlast technology-driven changes in our media format. What is this business model, if you can explain this in a little bit more comprehensive way?
Well, it's a really old traditional business model, although the business was not always aware of it. The problem with newspapers was that they were monopolies in most cities, and they could do what they wanted and still make money. There was one sure back in the 1950s who said, "I love this business. I could be brain dead and still make a lot of money." And now, of course, that's no longer true. But I first learned about this business model when I was a corporate staff of Knight Ridder, which at the time was the second largest newspaper company in the United States. It owned 32 newspapers in most of them in fairly large cities. And as it was explained to me, a newspaper produces two kinds of influence: commercial influence, which is for sale in the form of advertising, and societal influence, which is not for sale. And I loved it the minute I heard about it, because it is a rationale for producing excellent journalism. Now, the company I worked for, Knight Ridder Newspapers, had a tradition of producing excellent journalism, but that was mostly because of the choice of the family members who owned the company. It was a matter of family pride. But Al Juergensmeyer, who was their vice president for business at the time, came up with this model, which provided economic justification for their family pride. So, and I think it's really important now that newspapers no longer have the monopoly. It means that they still have a chance of something like a monopoly if they can become the most influential news source in their markets. And that's one reason why I wrote the book, to give them that idea and to spread what I had learned during my time at Knight Ridder, and to provide empirical evidence for it as well.
I'm having extremely interesting discussion with my distinguished guest, Professor Philip Mayer, who is Professor Emeritus School of Journalism and Mass Communication of University of North Carolina at the Chapel Hill. We are discussing his book, which has a number of very fundamental issues of journalism. The name of the book is Vanishing Newspaper, which is dedicated to saving journalism in the information age. I like to connect to the internet world, if you will allow me to make a very simplistic parallel, somewhat amateurish, because I believe that strong sentimentalism, which is attaching in the fact that we used to hold New York Times in our hands, drinking coffee, having our favorite corners in the newspaper, and thinking for the next morning with anticipation, this tradition is gradually dying out. And instead, especially young generation is going to internet, and that is their newspaper. Your thoughts of the correlation in between real newspaper and in internet information?
Well, I think the problem is not one of consumers preferring the internet, although I'm sure many do. The underlying problem is that the internet is sucking advertising away from newspapers, primarily classified advertising. In the year 2000, classified advertising was 40% of a newspaper's revenue. It's providing hardly any revenue now because Craigslist and other free or low-cost internet forms of classified advertising are much more efficient for the advertiser. And since that costs newspapers money, they are less reluctant to spend it on reporters, and so their news product has suffered. So the effect is indirect. It's not because consumers have a preference for reading while they're sitting in front of a screen. It's because they're looking for quality, and the quality in the print product is no longer as good because the advertising that supported it is no longer there.
Wow, this is a subject of great sadness. I just like to take a little avenue and say that if we're talking about different interests and different functions in life, like art and music, I believe that newspapers and some magazines are still presenting somewhat better quality than just a description of the pop culture. So sensationalism became such a well-spread way of a cheap attraction of young brains that, unfortunately, newspapers are suffering, and they, as you mentioned, cannot afford to hire high-quality journalism, because I believe there is a connection between comprehension and education. Saying that, I like to come back to your book and, in fact, talk about influence. You're making a very interesting statement regarding societal influence, which is not for sale, and commercial influence, which is. Could you possibly discriminate what is the principal difference between societal influence and commercial influence?
Well, the societal influence appears on the news and editorial pages, and the commercial influence is in the form of advertising. And newspapers traditionally have been very careful about making sure the reader knows which he or she is reading. The advertising has always been identified. Now, today, with the Internet, that distinction is not always so clear, because desperate advertisers trying to get their message out will often disguise it as editorial matter. And I know of some smaller newspapers, equally desperate, who do the same thing. This is not entirely new. I can remember way back when I was a boy in Kansas in the 1950s, some country weeklies would sell advertising disguised as editorial matter. In fact, for a fairly large paper in Topeka, Kansas, where I worked in 1951, would sometimes make a deal with advertisers. If you bought an ad of a certain size or signed a contract of a certain duration, you would be rewarded with what we called a blurb, which was a news story, something disguised as a news story, but was said nothing but good things about the advertiser. So that was unfair to the reader because it blurred that distinction. But for the influence model to work, the connection between commercial influence and societal influence has to be very carefully disciplined. The reader has to know when he or she is looking at a paid ad at the commercial influence and when he or she is looking at what's done for the good of the community and for the reader. If that trust is broken, then the influence model just falls apart. And newspapers that do things like I just described, blurbs described as disguised as news, are really undermining their business model. And they're undermining the interests of the advertiser, because the advertising is not as valuable if it's not in a medium that the public can trust. And if the public catches the newspaper disguising advertising as news, it will lose that trust, and everybody loses.
Extremely subtle and yet powerful difference you just described. The quality of advertisement, is it changing in your perception? Because it also can have some very strong segments of commercial value, but advertisement also can have some artistic and intellectual message. How do you see it? Yeah.
I've seen some amazing changes in my lifetime. The a famous economist put it well some years ago. He said that information consumes the attention of those who receive it, and therefore, as information increases, attention becomes more scarce. And so we are now living in a time of information surplus and attention scarcity. So the advertiser, having to break through all of the noise to get the audience's attention, has to do more and more desperate and crazy things. In the 1950s, when television was new, an advertising, a commercial was fairly long, and the camera was usually in a fixed position, and it was simply designed to give you information in a fairly slow, casual, comfortable manner. But as time has gone by, the designers of commercials have had to use shorter episodes, have more fast cuts, so that you never are looking at the same image on the screen for more than a few seconds. This taps into something that's hardwired into our brains based on our caveman ancestors' adaptations to worrying about wild animals sleeping at them out of the bushes. We are primed to notice something that is moving or that suddenly surprises us. And so that kind of clutter is getting more and more into advertising and also into news. I've seen some news stations that have very fast cuts so that you really can't concentrate on one thing for more than 30 seconds at a time. And this is, again, part of a desperate attempt to get our attention. The other thing that's happening is that you see more sex and violence on television as a way to get attention. It's a cheap way to get attention. And it's the source of that television news slogan, "If it bleeds, it leads," because crime stories are and stories of accidents are pretty cheap to cover. All you need is a car, a camera, and a police radio, and you can go wherever the trouble is happening and take pictures of it. And it's a cheap, easy way to get attention. Now, as information media become more competitive, they have to find more sophisticated ways to do that. So we haven't seen the end of this trend, but it's something worth worrying about.
What an incredibly comprehensive answer you gave me, which indeed creates somewhat puzzlement in my next question, because I'd like to ask more of what you just expressed, and yet I'm very well aware of time, and I wanted to ask you some other questions, but certainly you make all of us think to be so much more aware what society we're living in, because factual, superficial excitement is so much overpowering the depth of quality of intellectual information that one should think of a younger generation being educated for so many, many years. I'm always having this unresolved question: how is the young brain is going to look at the world, looking at the television, which is one of the most massive, great influence, of course, internet we talked about, and all these changes, very imposing and sometimes compulsive information, which is so unfortunately inappropriate for a young generation. Which brings another question about your teaching and indeed your tremendous influence on your generation. And how did you find the connection and perception of the students regarding these new aspects of journalism? What do they need to be prepared for? Perhaps I'm just catching a little bit with the idea of having a certification, but not yet there. I wanted to ask you about your teaching experience, and are you having particular concerns or opposite some hopes for young journalists?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the word certification, because that's what a journalism school does. Every time I give a student a passing grade in news writing, I am certifying him or her as having attained a definable level of skill. And, of course, there's no more accepted certificate for practicing journalism than a bachelor's degree in journalism. In fact, 90% of new hires in television station news departments have that degree, and a sizable majority for new hires at newspapers, or at least they did when I was teaching. But it's very hard to know what set of skills today's generation of students will need. As I was retiring, I like to say that I got old just in time, because I was able to get by teaching journalism the way it was practiced when I was a professional journalist. And it's changing so fast. New things are being invented that all I could tell my students was, you're going to be surprised, and the best I can do is prepare you to be surprised, because you will have to invent the next phase of journalism. I can't tell you what it's going to be like. It's up to you to find out.
I believe there is a universal tradition. If someone has roots, foundation, school of thinking, and of course, knowledge of history, somewhat philosophy, it creates a formation for understanding political idiosyncrasies. So I believe that your students certainly got this tremendous world of knowledge and major principles, which they will be able to apply for their future journalistic interests, which are so dynamically changing, as you mentioned.
I think that one thing that's changed is the need for specialization. Now, you can look back to the what's happened to media since the end of World War II, and in every category of media, specialized media have done relatively better than mass media. For example, magazines have done better than newspapers, and monthly magazines better than weekly magazines. Weekly community newspapers are better than metropolitan dailies. The narrower the audience you are trying to reach, the better you do. Now, I don't know where this is going to end, because the Internet makes the ultimate specialization possible, where an individual can design a program for himself or herself alone. But as you look back, you can see that even Broadway plays, they used to be in large theaters, and they're off-Broadway has done relatively better than Broadway, because they have smaller theaters and more specialized audiences. And you've seen it in cinema, of course, too. What used to be large movie theaters have been cut up into four or five smaller theaters, because movies are showing more specialized content now. When I was a boy, there were two movie theaters in town, and it didn't matter which one you went to, because each one would have content that was aimed at everybody, children, adults. There were no rating systems, because they weren't needed, because they were all designed to reach the largest audience possible. And that also was the old newspaper model, reach the largest audience possible. But the newspapers that survive, I think, will do so by figuring out ways to reach specialized audiences. And, of course, that creates all kinds of potential social problems, because if we're all looking at different media, how can we ever come to a common purpose and goals and policy agreements as a democracy? Nobody has figured out the answer to that one yet.
That will be your next book.
Well, yeah, except by the time I get around to writing it, I'll have another idea.
Well, speaking about the idea, I like to mention one thing. You commented on the fact that since your young age, you've already been in newspaper business. In fact, what I learned was very amusing, but also very revealing, that by age 14, I believe if I'm not wrong, you've been delivering newspapers, riding your bicycles in quite poor neighborhoods, and that was your first experience of a connection between newspaper and the sense of a community, which indeed you're also describing in your book, the emphasis of the community with a connection with the media. And then a few years later, you made a statement that by age 2043, we might not have newspapers altogether.
No, I didn't say that. You got that from The Economist, but they just made that up.
Oh, God.
Here's how that happened. In the first edition of my book in 2004, I showed a trend line based on the General Social Survey of the University of Chicago which asks people, how often do you read a newspaper? Every day, two or three times a week, once a week, or less than that. And I charted the percent who say they read a newspaper every day. And it was more than 70% back 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And this survey has been done every couple of years for all of that time. And the line descends at a pretty straight rate, dropping almost a percentage point a year. And so I said in the text accompanying that chart, I say, if you put a straight edge on that line and extend it to the zero point, that point would be in April 2043. But that's not a prediction, because that would assume that newspaper publishers are so stubborn that they're going to keep churning out newspapers until there's only one reader left. Obviously, that would be much too costly, and they would lose critical mass long before that. So straight line trends do not last very long in nature. And there would have to be one of two things would happen. Newspapers would keep deteriorating, in which case the line would steepen, or publishers would put more resources into their product and make it better, and the line would flatten out. In a chart in the new edition, I show a time in the 1980s when the number who read at least once a week stopped declining and became almost flat for the 1980s. And I looked around for some explanation for that, and I found it in data kept by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. They used to do, well, they still do, an annual census of newsroom employees. And in the 80s, they saw what was happening to their readership, and they tried desperately to invest in it and improve the quality, and they were hiring reporters instead of laying them off as they are now. And newspapers actually did get visibly better, and that flattened out the curve. So you can't predict the future by extending a line on the chart. The only reason for extending the line is to see how steep it is, to give you an idea, a better way to visualize it in your head. But what happens to the future depends very much on human behavior.
Well, thank you for clarification. And you say it was a victim of...
The Economist put it very colorfully. They said that 2043 In April 2043, the last weary reader will toss aside the last crumpled copy of a newspaper. I like that image.
Yes, exactly right. And I said to myself, my God, would this genius 14-year-old boy have such an incredible concept and prediction a few years later? And so I was taken by that. Well, respecting your time, we are coming to the end of this very unique interview with a creator and person who had tremendous dedication to the journalism with its roots, concept, history, philosophy. And I'm certainly very grateful to Professor Mayer, who was able to express himself in so many directions. Sometimes people are just becoming writers and they don't teach. Sometimes it's vice versa. It looks that Professor Mayer didn't have any limitations and didn't have any restrictions in the way he expressed his knowledge and his expertise. I would... stretch just a little bit. I hope you will permit me to do so, and ask your point of view regarding an international journalism. Obviously, for the last 20 years, the frequency and force of political changes made a tremendous impact on journalism, and needless to say, collapse of Soviet Union and face of terrorism. All of this challenge to the democracy. And I'd like to ask you, how do you see this can be comprehended by modern journalism with a respect for the old tradition?
I don't know. I like the old tradition of having correspondence. One of the proudest times for my old outfit, Knight Ritter, was when they had dozens of foreign correspondents scattered around the globe. And then when times got hard, they started pulling them back in. And the Knight Ritter organization no longer exists. And its successor, McClatchy Newspapers, has a handful of foreign correspondents, I think. But it's considered a luxury for traditional media. Broadcast media are good at covering crises and disasters, but not the day-to-day coverage that helps us compare one culture with another or one society's method of solving problems with another. And that's a shame, because we could learn so much from one another. And comparative international journalism would be a wonderful field. And I think there's an opportunity for somebody to do something not in a daily newspaper, but maybe in a magazine, and maybe with a website. If I were young, I would be out with a tin cup going to foundations asking for grants to try to set up an international comparative kind of journalism. There's an opportunity there for somebody. Maybe you could do it.
Well, thank you for challenging, creative question. I will be somewhat not terribly humble, but I had that particular thought. I don't even come close to your expertise and your horizon, but I feel it's somewhat perhaps efforts on the part of many. But just to think in this direction, because you're absolutely correct. If we will know more about each other, there will be less wars, there will be less of a confrontational and very cruel communication. The age of journalism will take it the most blossom and fruitful forms. Well, on this note, I like to thank you so much. It was more than one could expect. I certainly wish you the most fruitful years, which are ahead of you, and your mentioning of your age was not taken seriously. And the most important, I wanted to thank you for what you've done, for this extremely innovative and yet profoundly practical approach towards journalism, which makes everyone aware to what extent we have to take journalism seriously, with pride, with a sense of genuine democracy. And on this note, I will say goodbye to Professor Philip Mayer, who is a professor of emeritus of School of Journalism in Mass Communication of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Your presence in internet radio marks you as an innovator, too, and I wish you the best of luck with that.
Oh, thank you so much. I take it very seriously. And with my warmest regards to you and your family.
Thank you.
That was extremely meaningful interview. I have to confess that it is getting less and less frequent when classic school of thoughts and classic vision can so harmoniously see the challenges of our modern society. There is a tremendous conflict when I use the word harmoniously, and now I'm using the word conflict. I am contradicting myself, and I like to clarify this. Harmoniously, I feel it is because the substance of the visioner is so profound and so multitask that no issue of the modern challenging concept can be conquered without indeed this very profound understanding of classical journalism. One would ask, what is the classical journalism? In a very simple sense, it's the truth with responsible objectivity. That would be my determination. But in a more complex way, I would suggest that one would have privilege to read the book Vanishing Newspaper by Professor Philip Mayer, who had tremendous patience. He was so scrupulous in every aspect of journalism, especially connection between journalism and quality of information, the difference between influence and information. There are concepts which are collected with his tremendous understanding of our social needs, of commercial needs, of prosperity of the profit. So with all of that, I feel that we certainly have to take every single opportunity to open a book of such a great thinker. And frankly, even if not to read from the beginning to the end, but to read certain chapters, to read certain very profoundly well-expressed concepts, because this is our foundation for our personal thinking. I have to say that he had written some other books, one of which is Precision Journalism. This book actually was translated in four languages, Spanish, Turkish, Albanian, and Bulgarian. I particularly very thrilled that Eastern European was the country were able to have a sense of his thinking. I also quite thrilled by the fact that he is continuing to be very active in his writing and his participation in social and political events. It will not be a secret to say that his accomplishments would take quite a bit of a time to just mention, and his research interests seems to be just endless when it comes to ethics of journalism, when it comes to communication technology, when it comes to a variety of newspapers. It's just an incredible way of connection. My programs are dedicated a lot to connections which are not on the surface. After all, if we have some conceptual disagreement, this is disconnection, but it is a way of thinking, way of conceptualizing, and that's what we should not forget as a source for our mental, intellectual, and emotional development. I hope that this program will be one of the memorable for all of you, and I certainly looking forward to have some other special thinkers of our society. It is so, so incredibly valuable, especially in the midst of, unfortunately, well-engraved mentality of quick fix in the area of unfortunate and very unfairly, explicitly introduced commercials with violence, with some crime, sex, and all things which we certainly have to be aware of, but should not be a subject for such overwhelming quantity of it. I wanted to thank you all for your time listening, and I certainly will continue thinking in a more innovative way, which will bring our intellectual and emotional development to everyday life, which is so dynamic, so promising. On this note, that was your host. I'm Lina Mirmont. It's my another edition, Lina Live. Until next Tuesday. Thank you.